This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, a journey down into the mysteries of the subterranean. We'll talk with plant ecologist David Wolf about the life beneath our feet. It's a world teeming with life, and so much of it has yet to be explored. David Wolf is the author of Tales from the Underground, A Natural History of Subterranean Life. He points out that we have spent more time and effort examining small patches on the surface of the Moon and Mars than exploring the subterranean habitat of our own planet. In this, he quotes Leonardo da Vinci. We know more about the movement of celestial bodies than about the soil underfoot. Wolf says those words, spoken 300 years ago, still ring true today. David Wolf is professor of plant ecology in the Department of Horticulture at Cornell University, where he's also a member of the university's biogeochemistry program. Much of his research is focused on soil conservation and the impact of climate change on plants and soils. Listeners, I encourage you to join us with your questions this afternoon. Give us a call and join the discussion. Here are the numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. David Wolf's book, Tales from the Underground, A Natural History of Subterranean Life, is now available in paperback from Perseus Publishing. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. David Wolf, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hello, glad to be with you this afternoon.
You say what we can see from a walk on the surface of the earth, if we look at our feet and what's underneath them, is just the icing on the cake. Can you give us some idea of the richness of life that lies beneath our feet?
Well, really, it's research I did for the book and my own research at Cornell University has really changed my whole perspective of the natural world, and one of the objectives of the book is to kind of expand the reader's notion of that too. Just like when you look out at the ocean, anybody who's been snorkeling or scuba diving thinks of all that amazing diversity and beauty that's down below. And really what we're discovering, really much of it in the past couple decades, can do that same sort of thing to what you think of when you look out at a barren soil landscape.
Mm. Now, there's an illustration of a creature in the book called a water bear. What's the water bear?
Yeah, the water bear is one of my favorite underground creatures. Very tiny, usually not bigger than the dot of above an eye on a piece of newsprint, that kind of size. Some of them are actually microscopic. And they inhabit near the surface or shallow subsurface layers of soils. Very abundant. There can be thousands of them in a typical forest or garden soil. And they're actually most famous for their ability to, when conditions get rough for them, they can curl up into a tiny little ball, dehydrate from about 85% water content, like you and I have, to something like 3 to 5% water content into essentially a tiny little spore, and then survive for actually decades.
That's really interesting. Is there another organism or two you'd like to tell us about as an example of the diversity of life forms living underground?
Well, there's, of course, maybe we can get to it eventually in this interview. The ones that would be common to a lot of your listeners are earthworms and many of the organisms that are important in nutrient cycling for plant growth and decomposition and all of that. But there's even some more exotic creatures that have been discovered just in recent years. In fact, in the past couple of decades with new molecular biology tools, we've realized that we were probably underestimating the quantity of life right beneath our feet by about 99%. With our old Petri dish techniques, we were lucky if we were, capturing 1% of them. But by new, essentially kind of like DNA fingerprinting techniques, we've been able to realize just the tremendous diversity there. So tremendous diversity, and some of this is actually living miles beneath the surface. Began with some discoveries of microbes living in oil deposits that came up from the deep earth. In this hot oil, there were types of bacteria and other microbes living there. And really thrive under those extreme conditions. No light, no oxygen, no traditional carbon sources, but really kind of the base of what we call a dark food chain. deep beneath the earth.
Yeah. Now, how long ago was it we didn't think that anything could live that deep below the surface of the earth?
Well, these first the first notion that we might there might be something deep in the earth was sort of accidental, and people examining bacteria living in these oil products brought up from deep earth, and that was back in the 50s. But really, much of that information was regarded as probably the result of contamination as these materials were brought up to the surface. So not many people actually believed it until just a couple decades ago. In the 1980s, finally, some deliberate efforts were made to investigate life in the deep earth, and some careful techniques were developed to keep samples sterile as they were brought up. And it was became well established that there are indeed these very unusual types of creatures we never knew about before that are thriving there.
Yeah. In the book's second chapter, you write about some scientists who journeyed into the depths of a gold mine, and they went down 2 miles into the earth, and they were very careful to not to contaminate what they brought back mm-hmm. up with them. What did they find?
Yeah, well, they found some unusual creatures. They got permission from this company in South Africa that has probably about the deepest human-made structure in Earth, a gold mine that does go down almost 3 miles. And they got permission to go down there into a virgin part of the mine, which hadn't really been contaminated by humans yet, just after it was blown out. And so they knew they were getting to a part of the wall which had not been exposed to contamination before. And they used special techniques to excavate chunks of the rock. And they discovered quite a thriving community of microbes there, actually right near the gold vein. There is a carbon vein, and these microbes were living there. And some of them have pretty bizarre metabolisms. For example, some of them use iron oxide, which is essentially rust. They use the oxygen in iron oxide as their source of oxygen. So they essentially breathe in rust as a source of oxygen. Others breathe out methane gas, which is really the primary component of natural gas, a major fuel. And in fact, now we realize that many of our shallow natural gas deposits were probably produced by these methanogens.
Hmm. And these are, this group of microbes, of organisms, are called extremophiles.
Yeah, sort of collectively they're called extremophiles because they thrive in these, what we would call extreme conditions, yeah. Where, as I said, you know, no light, extreme high temperatures, often even exceeding the temperature at which water boils, because where they live at such depths that the pressures are very high, so that water stays in the liquid state at very high temperatures. So one of them, in fact, the real record holder, is called Pyrolobus fumeri. It thrives, its optimum temperature for growth is about 220 degrees Fahrenheit, and it freezes to death at about 190 degrees Fahrenheit. So you can see why we might come up with the term extremophiles for them.
In recent years, we've heard about organisms living in the deep, dark parts of the ocean. Are those organisms that live in extreme conditions in the oceans related to the extremophiles that are living deep within the earth?
Yeah, there's actually a great deal of overlap there in terms of the species we're coming up with. And because over geological time, what's at the bottom of the ocean now may have been deep in the earth at one time and vice versa. So there's been a lot of exchange over geological time of where these microbes mm-hmm. are located. But they have similarities. In some cases, we are finding even the same species living near these deep sea hydrothermal vents in sediments near the ocean floor there, again at very high temperatures, again without access to light, and usually very low oxygen or no oxygen at all. So very similar habitat. And as far as these microbes go, it's a similar type environment, and many of the same species are found in both locations, or at least the same general functional types.
Well, here's the question. How do they do that?
Well, the interesting thing, the quite fascinating thing to me is it may be that we are the adaptation, that a lot of evidence now points to the possibility that these creatures that we're finding deep in the earth and near these deep sea hydrothermal vents were the first creatures, they're the direct descendants of the first living creatures on Earth, because when Earth was first beginning, the surface conditions were just not conducive to life support. There was a constant meteor bombardment, extremely high ultraviolet radiation because there was no ozone shield, and volcanic eruptions, this kind of thing. So anything that might have come up to the surface and tried to make a living, its evolutionary path would have been nipped in the bud. So the underground was actually the safest place to be when life was first originating on Earth during its first billion years. So that alone, that circumstantial evidence seems to indicate they were the first first creatures. And it really is more a matter of how did creatures adapt to the high oxygen environment of the surface and that kind of thing, kind of the reverse notion.
Yeah. So now we've got the surface of the Earth, and to go back to your metaphor of the life on the surface as icing on the cake, now it looks like us humans are the sprinkles on the icing.
Yeah, it really does, you know, change one's perspective of the place of not only humans, but really all the plant and animal life that's easily visible to us on the surface. It puts that in a very different perspective. People have done some pencil-to-paper calculations and have now estimated that based on the sampling we've done, first of all, even just right in the soil, right beneath our feet, there's much more life than we once thought. And then when you take into account these vast communities deep in the Earth, that the actual total quantity of life below ground may exceed all that we see above ground. So that's still quite hard for me to grasp that when I walk through the forest near my home and see all this, you know, the large trees and the deer and wildflowers, et cetera, that there could be a community of life below ground that's actually much more vast than all of that.
Yeah. Well, let's come a little closer to the surface and talk about some of the things that we encounter in our own backyards. There's a chapter in the book, very fascinating, about earthworms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we see creatures like earthworms and roly-polies in the soil in our backyards, we know we've probably got some good soil there. But that wasn't known until relatively recently, and it was thanks to Charles Darwin.
Yeah, it's actually Charles Darwin, among soil biologists, soil ecologists, he's sort of known as the grandfather of their field of study, kind of a little-known fact to the general public because he's so much more famous for his work in evolution. But actually, Darwin got interested in earthworms not long after his beagle voyage, before he had ever published any of his evolution work. He was visiting his Uncle Josh's farm, and his Uncle Josh showed him evidence of earthworm activity, bringing soil up to the surface and all of this. And at the time, actually, believe it or not, it's hard for people to realize this today or recognize this, but earthworms were considered actually to be a minor pest of plants is what most people thought. They didn't realize that they were doing this important job of aerating the soil and mixing the soil and essentially sort of forming, being the blenders of the underground, you might say. And so it wasn't really recognized. He began studying them, and it was a 40-year-long project of his. And finally, his last book was a 200-page-plus treatise just on earthworms called The Formation of Vegetable Mold Through the Action of Worms with details about their habits. And quite a fascinating book as he goes into, he's very meticulous about his studies, just as he was with his work with evolution. He was, again, fascinated with how over long periods of time, small changes can have a big impact. And that's what fascinated him about the worms, that over small periods of time, they can have such a major impact on our soils.
Yeah. And this is an area that is still wide open for study, isn't it?
Certainly is. I mean, in the case of earthworms, we're still learning more about what they do and different types. One interesting fact is that the common nightcrawler earthworm that any of the fishermen out in your audience would be familiar with is not native to North America. It was actually brought in by the Europeans. And some of these earthworms and other organisms, we're doing a lot of work with them now, and this gets into some of the research I do at Cornell, looking at how farmers can better manage this biological component of soils to their benefit, to the benefit of crops, and have them working for us instead of sort of always just thinking about soil organisms as being disease pests in there and that sort of attitude. We realize there's a lot of beneficial organisms as well as potential pathogens, and a lot of interesting work going on in that area.
Yeah, well, our mothers always told us, as you point out in the book, wash your hands when you're out playing in the dirt when you come in, which is good advice, but really it turns out that soil is relatively pretty clean. It's pretty healthy.
Well, as I mentioned, you know, we now know that within just a half teaspoon of soil you might pick up from your garden soil or from out in your lawn or anywhere, there's probably 10,000 distinct species of bacteria in that kind of small sample. And we only know about a handful of those. And it's true that a few of them are potentially disease-causing. For example, one of the most famous human diseases that is very much a soil-borne pathogen is tetanus, which was a big problem many years ago. So there are the bad guys there, but they're really outnumbered by many potentially beneficial organisms that play a very important role in helping plants take up nutrients, recycling nutrients. Essentially, for example, much of the nitrogen has to be recycled through just a handful of soil microbial species. So they play a very, very important role.
Yeah. David Wolf is our guest here this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a plant ecologist at Cornell University, professor of plant ecology, and he's the author of Tales from the Underground, A Natural History of Subterranean Life. The book is published by Perseus, just now out in a paperback edition. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions. You can join us with a telephone call in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL, 333-WILL. Speaking of nitrogen, National Public Radio did a two-part series recently on Fritz Haber. The man who fixed nitrogen. Mm-hmm. Nitrogen is critical to all living things on the earth. Maybe you would talk with us a little bit about fixing nitrogen, the importance of nitrogen, and maybe you'd like to just say something briefly about Fritz Haber.
Sure, yeah, he's a fascinating character. Well, first, just about nitrogen. It's one of those really key elements of all life that we know of, just like we have carbon, oxygen, hydrogen. Nitrogen is one of the key elements. It's in the genetic material that's in each of our cells and each of our bodies. It's part of all the proteins that are in our bodies. So nitrogen is just a very important player in terms of life. So we all need nitrogen. And actually, we're actually surrounded by a lot of nitrogen in the atmosphere. With every breath we take, about 80% of that air is actually nitrogen in the form of N2 diatomic nitrogen gas. Unfortunately, almost no living creatures can access that nitrogen. Unlike, for example, we can access oxygen with the hemoglobin in our blood. But we can't access this nitrogen, and neither can almost anybody else. Only a handful of soil microbes have evolved that special capability. And they live in the soil. Some of them hook up with plants and form a symbiotic relationship living on the roots of plants, legume plants. And they have the ability to take this nitrogen gas that's in the soil air spaces around them, convert it to an organic form of nitrogen that essentially then feeds the rest of us. It moves into the food chain from them. They convert it into a form of nitrogen. It goes into their cells, and then, you know, they get eaten, et cetera, and it enters the food chain. So all the nitrogen in all of our cells essentially was funneled through this handful of soil microbes at one time or another. So in terms of, you know, the importance of soil life to human life and all life, as we know, that's one of the best examples. Hmm. Now, going back to Fritz Haber, well, we were really completely dependent on these organisms for, as I say, all the nitrogen that we use. But at some point, it became apparent in the early 1900s that crop production was, despite the fact of doing some rotation with legume crops that do have this symbiotic relationship with the nitrogen fixers, that crop production was not really, there was concern that it wasn't going to meet human needs for food as the human population continued to expand. And there were some natural deposits of organic nitrogen that people could use for fertilizer, but those too were running out. And so too, the issue of recycling nitrogen with the use of manure, there were limitations imposed with that system in terms of food production. So the search was on for finding some way for us to do what these bacteria have done for millions, billions of years, and that's get nitrogen from the air and convert it into a form we knew something about. I might also mention one other issue here was that nitrogen is a major component in most of our important explosives, TNT being the classic example. And this was just prior to World War I, and so there was also a need for nitrogen for bombs. And anyway, along came Fritz Haber from one of the German labs at that era. The German laboratories were really arguably the most sophisticated in the world, and he tackled this tough quest, and it took him several years, a few little accidents in the laboratory, but finally he was able to figure out a way to essentially do what the microbes have done for eons. The only thing is, for humans to do it, we have to do it at extremely high temperatures and pressures. It's a very energy-intensive process, high heat process. So we have to do it that way. The microbes can do it all at room temperature, just in the soil beneath our feet. But we have figured out how to do that. And much of the nitrogen fertilizer being put on crops today comes through that same synthetic process.
Yeah. Fritz Haber is a fascinating man, because not only did he do something that has been a real boon for humanity, but he also turned around and suggested its use as a weapon. And he's an interesting character, because there's some very tragic aspects to his life. And for folks who are interested, I would suggest they would go to the NPR website and look in the archives for Fritz Haber. And that would be npr.org. But in the meantime, not only was he an interesting man because of he gave a boost to humanity in terms of our ability to feed ourselves.
He really raised the carrying capacity of the earth to support humans, yeah, is one way to look at
right.
it.
But then again, he also he was the man who suggested using this technology to create chemical weapons.
Yeah, also, yeah, in World War I, he was, you know, a very serious German patriot. In World War I, he, because he was such a great chemist, the German government brought him on to help develop poison gases and this sort of thing. And he did a great job of that. And Germany used some of those things in World War I. And needless to say, after post-World War I, he was not viewed very positively by any of his scientist colleagues outside of Germany. Despite this, though, in Germany, he was still considered, a hero of sorts, and he was still well-respected, and his work with the nitrogen fertilizer production was, of course, well-respected. So he had a thriving lab, but then along came World War II, and it turned out that he's part Jewish. And the Hitler regime would not tolerate that, even though he had made so many important contributions to Germany. Hitler essentially threw him out. Max Planck, a famous physicist, went to Hitler, the story goes, and pleaded for some pardon for Haber because he was such an important scientist. And Hitler's response was, well, if, you know, cleaning up the white race in Germany means doing without science for good science for a few years, we'll do without good science. Mm-hmm. So he actually died in exile about a year or two mm-hmm. later.
Yeah. Well, with the carrying capacity of the planet has been increased, but also now we have excessive amounts of nitrogen in the environment. What's being done to address the problems caused by our ability now to fix nitrogen?
Well, yeah, so with this, once Haber found a way for us to create our own fertilizer nitrogen, we really went to town with that and started putting nitrogen on all our crops. And in many cases have been historically a bit sloppy with that. Often it's used as sort of an insurance and why not put on a little extra just in case sort of attitude has been sort of the historical approach to it. And this was really before we recognized that too much nitrogen added to our environment can be a very negative thing. A nitrate is one form of nitrogen that can come from these fertilizers. It can get leached into groundwater, and it actually can make the water poisonous to drink, especially for infants. Another thing is nitrogen flowing into our streams and waterways can lead to algal blooms, particularly in marine coastal areas. And these algae are stimulated in these waterways. They zap all the oxygen from the water, and everything else in the water, all the other living forms, start to die off. So a lot of negative repercussions. But in the past, as we've realized these pollution problems from nitrogen, there's actually been a concerted effort among the agricultural scientific community as well as among farmers to try to do a better job. And there's a lot of some simple solutions. One is splitting applications of nitrogen instead of just pouring it all on at the beginning of the growing season. Farmers are learning ways to sort of spoon feed their crops the nitrogen. Another thing is going back to the legumes, using these plants that form these symbiotic relationships with these bacteria in the soil to fix nitrogen, going back to rotating with them in a way that provides a more measured amount of nitrogen for the subsequent cash crop growth. So there's a whole number of techniques. One aspect of research I'm working on at the moment is looking at a very common soil fungus that's found in almost all soils. It's called Trichoderma. And we suspect, we haven't quite proved the point now, it's in the research in progress, but there's the possibility that this particular fungus attaches to the roots of crop plants and helps them access nitrogen in a more efficient way. So farmers could apply a little less nitrogen and still get the same kind of yields. So there's a range of things there. And I do have to say that I think the farming community is joining up with the agricultural scientific community and trying to make some changes.
Hmm. David Wolf, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a professor of plant ecology at Cornell University. He's the author of Tales from the Underground, a Natural History of Subterranean Life. Listeners, you can join us with your telephone calls in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. My name is Celeste Quinn, and our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frayne. Let's talk with a listener now waiting for us on the toll-free line in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi there.
I want to inquire about removing nitrates, I guess, from municipal water. I understand that there are some municipal plants that I guess they use a kind of a resin method for reducing the nitrogen. And now I want to inquire, do you suppose that's, I think it may be anion resins, and I'm wondering if maybe, well, are you acquainted with the procedure for removing, for lowering the nitrogen content in municipal water?
Well, I, in general, I'm familiar with the fact
that's all I needed was just generalities.
Yeah.
Now, one thing which I surmised was that since anions will take up acid materials, might it be done by converting the nitrates to nitric acid and then picking that up on the anion resin?
Well, actually, nitrate itself has a fairly strong negative charge and can be picked up on resins fairly easily. Another thing is, nitrate's a fairly easy molecule to work with. So chemically, there are some chemical treatments that water supply agencies can use. One thing I want to mention is kind of an interesting biological approach to a solution to this problem, and that is before these nitrates get into some of our waterways, what people are looking at is developing wetland areas that tend to promote the growth of a type of bacteria called denitrifying bacteria. And so they do very well in waterlogged soils. And if water flows through these wetland areas and through these waterlogged soils before it gets into our streams and rivers, the denitrifying bacteria take that that nitrate and they convert it right back up into nitrogen gas that goes back up into the atmosphere. So it kind of completes the cycle and puts the nitrogen right back where we got it from. And there's been some work actually in the Illinois, Indiana area because there's a lot of concern about farming leading to a lot of nitrogen flowing down the Mississippi River basin. And there's some people doing some work on kind of creating a new wetland byways there to for that purpose.
Yeah. In return to the anions, I understand on cations, you know, they're very readily picked up on the cation resins. But on the anion, do you think it would have to be converted to an acid in order to be picked up on the anion?
To my knowledge, I think there are techniques where that you don't have to do that first. It's possible, and this is an area where, you know, I don't really do research in that area. It's possible that maybe there's a more efficient approach by converting it first to some more acidic type form. I'm not really sure about that.
Yes. All right. And thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Questions are encouraged this afternoon, 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. If you're just joining us this afternoon, we're talking about the life beneath our feet. We're journeying down today into the mysteries of the subterranean. David Wolfe is our guest. He's the author of Tales from the Underground, A Natural History of Subterranean Life. Let's go back to that idea that life on Earth may have emerged in the subterranean. Another interesting chapter in the book, the role of clays in the origin of life being examined today. In that area, what are some of the leads scientists are working on?
Well, one thing about clays is they're different than other particles of soil in that they're really microscopic crystals, and they have an electrostatic charge. And so that's what that property is what makes them possibly important in the origin of life. This electrostatic charge on their microscopic surfaces at the atomic level allows them to attract other types of molecules to them, and these molecules then can get lined up in various ways. So that people have done, in terms of some ongoing research, people have mixed these clays into test tubes and added, for example, some simple nucleotides, which are the sort of the backbone molecules that are important in our genes, or they've used poured amino acids in there, which are the backbone molecules for proteins. And they have found that clays allow these amino acids or the nucleic acids to line up in certain patterns, and then sometimes the nucleic acids hook up to each other, and voila, you have sort of like a little chain of something that resembles genetic material. So one thought is that these clays actually acted as catalysts or like enzymes for synthesizing some of the first biomolecules, you might say, before there really was life on Earth. So they may have resulted in the construction of some very crude gene-like or protein-like molecules that eventually became more and more lifelike over, of course, many millions of years.
Mm. Are textbooks keeping pace with what we're learning?
Actually, you know, they're still a ways off. I mean, I now and then peer into our general biology text we use at Cornell and see where they're at. And even at a major university like Cornell University, there's still some catching up to do with all the textbooks. So there's a time lag there, definitely. Some of the areas, of course, are a bit controversial, but some really are not. And there always is, I think, a time lag. That's what sort of fascinated me about this subject matter as I talk to my friends in the field of microbiology and some of these other fields where they're making these quite amazing discoveries. I realized that the general public wasn't really getting wind of this stuff, and that was, you know, part of the motive for my writing this book, to kind of expose people to some of this really fascinating stuff.
Yeah. Boy, it's like it's time to go back to school.
Well, and really, I mean, one of the most important things to me is that, you know, the quantity and diversity of the natural world is really twice what we thought it was just a couple decades ago. And much of that new material, this new living material that we're now aware of, is below ground. So the natural world around us is, well, I should say beneath us also in this case, you know, is twice what we thought it was just even when I was in college a couple decades ago.
Mm. Speaking of time lags, and what's controversial just a short time ago now is well accepted or fairly well accepted. There's an interesting chapter in the book called Shaking the Tree of Life that involves a professor of microbiology here at the University of Illinois by the name of Carl Woese.
Mm-hmm.
How is Woese changing our understanding of the Tree of Life?
Well, Carl Wells has created his work has created a revolution in a few different fields of science, most importantly probably in evolutionary biology. He pretty much brought the field of evolution into the molecular age, moved us beyond the sort of eye of the beholder perspective on what evolution was all about, which is what we had to rely on when all we had were fossils to look at. But what Carl realized was that at the microbial level, at the level of single-celled bacteria, et cetera, one fossil looks like another, and you can't really make much sense of it. And yet those bacteria and other microbes, they've been evolving on Earth for a billion or 2 years longer than all of us multicellular creatures. So he used new molecular techniques to study essentially their gene sequences, and he started rebuilding the whole evolutionary tree of life. And when he got to work on this, one of the major things he discovered is that just within the bacteria realm, if you compare the diversity of genes of certain groups of bacteria from another, they are as different from each other genetically as plants are from humans, for example. So in other words, if we want to call plants and animals two different kingdoms, then within just the bacterial realm alone, there's more than a dozen, quote, kingdoms. And now, in fact, the whole notion of kingdom has sort of been turned on its head, and we now look at Earth life as three major domains: the bacteria, the eukaryotes, which is a group that encompasses plants, animals, fungi, and all these, the other kind of major kingdoms all lumped into that one that we used to think about as major kingdoms. And then a whole new group of organisms that he discovered that look like bacteria, but they're as genetically distinct from bacteria as a fungus is from a human. They're called archaea. So he discovered an entire new domain of life called archaea, just as big a group in many ways, at least in terms of their genetic uniqueness, as bacteria. So just can't say enough about the amazing discoveries that he took on. It all really began in a very modest way, him plugging away in the late 70s, one of the pioneers in molecular biology, studying the genetics of bacteria. He wasn't even focusing on important disease-causing bacteria. Many people criticized him for, what's he spending all his time doing? Mm-hmm. But he was quite convinced that, by studying these direct descendants of Earth's first life forms, he would find secrets to the genetic code itself and that sort of thing. And so he felt it was important, and he just stumbled upon some pretty amazing things.
Yeah. There's a really wonderful illustration in that chapter of how the Tree of Life is now looking mm-hmm. at this point. And I think it really says a lot about how to think about where we are on the Earth, because plants and animals are at the tippy top of the branches, and all these other things are at the roots. And if you think of, it's a pretty good metaphor, I think, because if you think of a tree, well, you're often able to snip off lots of the tips of branches, but you better not screw around with the roots, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that keeping with that metaphor, the roots are definitely going to outlast us. I feel pretty confident about that. They're the bacteria and these other unique microbial types that are at the base of the evolutionary tree. They've been around for, three and a half billion years, and they're going to be around for a long time hereafter. So we're pretty confident about that. Yeah, the new evolutionary tree of life, plants, animals, and fungi, which many of us learned in school were these three big kingdoms, pretty much describing all of life, are just a few tiny little twigs, fairly insignificant when you look at the new evolutionary tree. As I said, you can look at just the bacterial branch, and there's a whole slew of branches and twigs coming off of there. So, based on this new genetic evidence, it does put in perspective, where we are at. And, it's this eye of the beholder sort of approach to thinking about life on Earth. And it is true, certainly, no denying that plants and animals and fungi have fantastic morphological diversity, great shapes and sizes and et cetera, and whereas all these bacteria, et cetera, they all do kind of look alike. But if we're talking about the basic genes and the pathway of evolution, we have to take into account this genetic evidence, which illustrates all this microbial genetic diversity on our planet.
Hmm. A better knowledge about the richness of the underground has got to help us preserve its richness, don't you think?
Well, you know, again, one of the goals of the book, I hope, is that people, you know, after reading it, do get that sort of sense that this is, wow, this is just an amazing habitat. You know, it's not just not just dirt, just like when you look out at the ocean, it's not just water. I mean, it's a fantastic habitat that actually goes down very deep and has a very long history. And if you want to focus on the benefits to humans, that, you know, it goes on and on. Now, we wouldn't be here at all without them, for sure, and we get important pharmaceuticals from the soil. Some of these new, strange, extreme types of organisms that we're finding deep in the earth are being used for bioremediation of toxins because they live in these extreme conditions. They can, a lot of things that we call toxins, they use as a food source. So all kinds of, you know, human benefits of all these things. But more than that, just, you know, what I hope is that people reading the book, next time they take a walk in the woods or working around in their garden, they just have a much greater appreciation for this, you know, the world that's beneath them there.
Yeah. Before we wrap up this afternoon, I want to ask you about the burrowing owl.
Hmm.
What a fascinating creature.
Yeah, they're a really cute little charismatic little creatures. They're the type of owl that very small. They could fit like in the palm of your hand.
And we're off the air.
Are we off the air?
Are we back? David Wolf, are you there?
I'm here. Yeah, I'm still here.
Our transmission went down there for a moment. Okay, we were talking about the burrowing owl.
The burrowing owls, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so these are creatures that are actually kind of burrow borrowers in that they don't really usually build their own underground nests. In fact, they usually inhabit the nests, the underground nests built by prairie dogs or ground squirrels and a couple other types of creatures along those lines. But they live underground and have quite an amazing little life history story, interesting family life. They usually mate with the same partner for life, and quite fantastic little creatures. Very dependent on, as I said, prairie dog and other creatures for their burrowing, for their burrows. And one issue I bring up in that chapter you mentioned is that prairie dogs have suffered tremendously from a long-term campaign to poison them out of existence. Many of throughout the Midwest, it's been a long history of considering them as competing with the prairie dogs as competing with cattle for forage, and so the prairie dog populations have just gone way down over the past 100 years. And as a result, the burrowing owls, of course, have also suffered, as well as some other animals that are very dependent on prairie dogs, which are really a keystone species of our grasslands of the American West.
Oh. Let's squeeze in one more caller before we have to wrap it up this afternoon. On line one in Mount Zion, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. If I understand you correctly, then looking at bacteria from the genetic point of view and looking at the overall evolutionary scale, we might be able to rethink our position in the world instead of being Earth-centered universe with everything spinning around us, in other words, man-centered. This might come out to reshape our centricity, evolution-wise.
Well, I feel it definitely does. I mean, in the old tree of life that might have been in the older textbooks really shows that the animal kingdom as, you know, one major branch, and plants as another major branch, and often then there's often a third branch for fungi, and you know, that's about it in many of the older texts. Whereas now what we see is that the whole plant and animal kingdoms are really just tiny little twigs. So it certainly does, it helps us to recognize how long evolution has been going on in the earth, how much of that, virtually all of that, has been at the microbial realm. And in terms of the genetic diversity that is on the earth, more than two-thirds of that is with these little microbes that all, they look alike to us, so we can't, you know, to the naked eye or to under a microscope, we can't see much difference. But especially now as we're, you know, interested in thinking about genetic diversity and how, you know, what we might, how we might be able to use genetic diversity it's good to know that most of that is to be found in the microbial realm and not just in plants and animals. So it definitely changes our perspective. Also, changes our perspective. Some of this work changes our perspective of life on other planets, because there's thoughts that if life, these early unusual microbes I was talking about, evolved in the deep subsurface of Earth, there are subsurface of Mars, and some of the moons of Jupiter have similar subsurfaces, and life may have evolved there as well.
There, we've got to wrap it up.
Okay.
David Wolf, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
I enjoyed talking with you.
David Wolf, professor of plant ecology at Cornell University. He is professor of plant ecology in the Department of Horticulture at Cornell, where he's also a member of the university's biogeochemistry program. And our thanks this afternoon to Cornell for providing the high-quality phone line we enjoyed this afternoon. If you're interested in this topic, if you're interested in reading more about extremophiles, water bears, earthworms, prairie dogs, and burrowing owls, look for Tales from the Underground, A Natural History of Subterranean Life. The book is published now in a paperback edition from Perseus Publishing.